come with me if you want to drink great coffee. You probably know that the secret to the best coffee is freshly roasted beans. But unless you have a time machine, chances are you're drinking stale coffee. That's okay, because while technology has yet to plague us with a robot war, it has blessed us with an easy way to start getting the best coffee you've ever had delivered regularly to your home or office. That's right, I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans that are directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends, roasts, and grinds to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, Sparkplug arrives at your house within a week of being custom roasted here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. Want your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen? No problemo. Just plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Hasta la vista, coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Now listen to me very carefully. Hey, Motion Picture Maniacs, and thank you for popping in the Next 100 Project as we continue reviewing movies of all shapes and sizes. Speaking of movies, we like to spoil those, so watch out! I am the Austrian Infiltration Specialist, and with me yet again is the Savior of Humanity, my wife Bev.
That's me.
There will be many Arnold impersonations in this podcast. There's already been 5 or 6 in the first minute and a half, 2 minutes.
I think I've done all my Arnold impersonations because I always end up devolving into some weird Dracula accent as soon as I've been speaking as him for more than one sentence.
Dracula, huh?
Dude, I don't know. He always turns into Transylvanian.
Becomes Romanian, or Transylvanian, yeah. Okay, well then, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Arnold has made 7 movies that start with the letter T, not including the word the, or his cameo in Terminator Salvation. Name the 7, and which of those 7 are the top 5 biggest hits of his career in unadjusted dollars?
I didn't look this up because I wanted to see if my guess was correct.
Ooh, intriguing.
Yeah, so the 7 are Terminator the original, Terminator 2, Total Recall, True Lies, Twins, Terminator Genesis, and Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines.
Is that 7? I think you got them all, yes.
Yeah, okay. So I'm pretty sure that at least 4 of the 5 are Terminator 2, Total Recall, True Lies, and Twins.
That's 4 of the 5.
And I think the first Terminator is the 5th.
Nope.
Damn it. Is it Terminator Genesis?
No.
Rise of the Machines?
Yes. Ah. The order is unadjusted now, so the actual money it made in the year it came out. T2, then T3, then True Lies, Total Recall, and Twins. And you already said the other 2 T movies, the Terminator, the original one, and Terminator Genesis, which actually was a bomb in North America, but did very well in China.
Hmm.
I was reading last night that there was talk of doing a sequel or maybe even 2 sequels because of that success alone. China, apparently next year, will become the biggest market in the world for movies. But because it didn't really succeed and they have other things going on, Paramount, who now have the rights to the Terminator movies, said no.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I just read that. I think that might be a new development because I had heard that regardless of the basic failure of Terminator Genesis, and for the record, I didn't hate it. Everyone else hated it. I thought it was okay. It was fun. It had its moments. Not hateable, although Jai Courtney as Kyle Reese. No. That guy's the Sam Worthington of... he was also in a Terminator movie. He was in Terminator Salvation. They both suck. But I'm a big fan of the whole series, and we'll talk more about that as the podcast goes on.
I love T2, but that was the only one I'd seen up until I finally watched the original Terminator. I don't know, it's been the last few years, and I've never seen the additional sequels.
Interestingly, I watched the first one after we saw the second one. Just thought I should get myself refreshed, although I said to you not long ago, I could do T2 without any notes at all, actually. We'll see how it works out when I'm staring at notes, trying to listen to you, and formulate opinions and thoughts and whatnot. So, the Next 100 Project's 23rd movie, Terminator 2, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, but because we're doing it now, it obviously didn't make the Top 100 lists. Carolco, who the fuck are they? Well, they're long gone. Defunct studio. And TriStar released the blockbuster on the July 4th weekend in 1991, so this is the 25th anniversary coming up. July 4th for the Americans is Monday. Canada Day for us is Friday, and we will be off next week because of those holidays.
And I haven't seen a lot of promo for this, but I saw it on IMDb that apparently for the 25th anniversary, a 3D version is being produced.
Why do they do that? The movie's great the way it is. And it wasn't made that way. That's the other thing. Avatar, James Cameron, yes, that was made for 3D. That was the whole point of that movie. If it wasn't in 3D, it would have been stupid. I've never seen that movie a second time because the story doesn't really hold up. But the effects on the huge screen in 3D, okay, that's where you got to see Avatar. But when you jury-rig a movie that wasn't made that way, what is the point?
Well, among James Cameron's many gifts, one of his greatest talents is making money.
He is a blockbuster maestro. Okay, well, for those who aren't familiar with Terminator 2, Bev, you probably should explain it with the skinny.
Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger reprise their roles as Sarah Connor and the android T-800 sent from the future this time to protect Edward Furlong's John Connor from Robert Patrick's sleek and menacing T-1000 and to fly in the face of even the most basic tenets of time travel logic.
Yep, okay, so in a nutshell, policeman does not emerge from steel mill after dogged pursuit of three fugitives. They gotta say, hey, their guy went in there and didn't come out. Where is he? Where are our people we were trying to get in the first place? Those three people that were committing all kinds of crimes. In fact, blowing up Cyberdyne earlier that same night. Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes critics on Terminator 2. 93% of them liked it, and 94% of audiences. The movie's 41st on the IMDb's 250. That's a pretty impressive ranking. And it's also 108th on the Box Office Mojo Top 200 adjusted for inflation. And it was number one in 1991. The Silence of the Lambs, we covered that for the Top Niner Project, was fourth in 1991. But an action movie, one of the greatest action movies of all time, and certainly one of the greatest action sequels of all time. Your thoughts on that right now, Bev?
Well, I'm not nearly an impartial judge of this film because it came out when I was just the perfect age. In 1991, I would have been 13. And I was right in the eye of the storm of that massive cultural impact that it had at the time. So often, I'm disappointed when I revisit films that I loved when I was younger, but I really wasn't this time. I haven't seen this film in decades. It's not without its flaws, but who cares? It's just so damn cool and fun.
And having watched the first one again recently, I still say it's maybe the better story. And that's one thing about James Cameron. He's better with story than he is with screenplays, like the Wachowskis, more so in the Matrix days. Their stories are really good. Their screenplays are not so good. And James Cameron's the same.
Oh, man, yeah.
When you talk about lines of dialogue in Titanic, we talked about that plenty in that podcast. He's better at actually constructing where we're going to go with something than giving people things to say.
One of his major flaws, I mean, he doesn't write dialogue all that well. That's a given. But he also says things that don't need to be said out loud. He will show things and then he will tell you, and he will tell you in the worst, dumbest way.
What's an example?
Most of the Sarah Connor VOs. In a crazy world, maybe the sanest thing is letting this robot be my son's dad. But my favorite worst line in this film is, I know not why you cry.
See, it's something like I can never do.
Something I can never do. Come on.
I don't agree. With that one, I do not agree. I've said this to many people over the years about this movie. I think that is Arnold Schwarzenegger's greatest acting moment. He doesn't have a lot of great acting moments, although as much as people deride Junior, he's not bad in that movie. But I think that line where the machine is learning after only a few days to say, I care about you, but I can't do the same thing. And for a guy who's never going to be considered one of the great actors of all time, I think he plays it quite well. And I've also been moved, I would say, actually to tears, I'll admit it, by the end of that movie. I wasn't with you when we saw it. I just wasn't in the mood, I guess, to cry that day. But I think that in general, the ending of that movie is very emotional for a movie that isn't emotional otherwise. Maybe because the actors sell it very well, including the young Edward Furlong.
Yeah, and I think you don't really anticipate in the end that he's going to sacrifice himself to save the future because the evil has been thwarted. You think that they're safe. Okay, well, a happy ending would be the three of them walking away, kind of like their weird, demented family that they've already
nuclear
set
family.
Up. Yeah,
like in Aliens, the James Cameron movie from 1986. Had they survived, Michael Biehn, who's in that, but also in The Terminator, and Sigourney Weaver, the girl, and then their dog, the android, Bishop, nuclear family there, too. After a tragedy that happens, and they managed to find something that would work for them, although the next movie, Alien 3, ruins that whole concept. But anyway, back to what you were saying.
Oh, well, we were talking about Schwarzenegger, right? And I'm never going to accuse Schwarzenegger of being a good actor, but I think he deserves credit for his physical performance. Mm-hmm. It is not easy to convincingly move like a robot would. He never overdoes it, and that's a great example, actually. I don't know why you cry, but it's something I can never do. There's no emotion in him. It's conveyed, but not through his performance, and he never gives in to that impulse to make things model, and he always stays mechanical, and he just performs all his movements in the most straightforward and efficient manner, just like a robot would. Mm-hmm. It's really incredible. If you watch just the minutiae of his performance, he deserves more credit than he gets. I agree with you.
This is one of the most iconic roles in cinema history, and it's certainly his most iconic role. And that's saying something. The guy's got a few great characters, including Conan, for that matter.
I think it was Ebert who gave him credit for perhaps his greatest genius isn't necessarily his acting, but his understanding of his own strengths and limitations, yes, and that right. he always picks the role that is perfect for himself and that he can pull off.
And when you watch the first film and you look at the way he does things, he talks about this in the making of. There's really interesting documentaries on both DVDs and Blu-rays, I suppose, of these movies, the first and second movie. But in the first one, he talks about how when he turns his head to look at something, he has his eyes go as far to the left or to the right as they can, and then he moves his head. Because efficiency. He's like a camera, mm-hmm. effectively. Don't move the head until you need to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's a good touch. I don't know if he came up with that. Maybe Cameron did or someone else did. But it's a really good touch in that first movie. And because he's stalking them so much, he has to be a camera. In this movie, he's always on the lookout for what's behind him, what's coming after him, being the T-1000. And we talk about the first two movies of the whole series. The first one is a horror film. The second one is an action film, mostly just like the Alien series, which James Cameron participated in when he made Aliens. The first movie is a horror film, right down to the surviving woman kind of ideal. Halloween did that. Alien did that. Terminator did that. The virtuous woman survives. And then the second movie in the series, Terminator and Alien, is all about balls out action.
Yeah, they have a lot of similar themes where you have super strong, badass female protagonists protecting with the motherly instincts and this robot that, you know, it's funny because in Alien, the robot turns bad, and then in Aliens, the sequel, the robot turns out to be her ally. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, you have, more so in Terminator 2, the robot really is this badass protector, like he is definitely a driver of the action. But it's funny how the story with him and Edward Furlong is John Connor. There's this safety father figure. He's like his security guard, but also his father figure. There's also this little boy and his dog mm-hmm. story because he's teaching him how to be cool. And possibly what a lot of people call one of the biggest flaws of the film is these scenes where he's teaching him to high five. And
in the desert, the weakest part of the film, about the midway point through. And also when they could reasonably get away. Sarah makes a decision to go after Dyson, and then they all end up going to Cyberdyne. But if they play it smart, they could all get away, and the T-1000, as smart as that machine is never going to find them. In fact, they have more than one opportunity to get away and never be found by the T-1000 before they even find Sarah at the mental hospital. But, of course, John insists they go there. But they keep on doing these things, and I got to do the Hitchcock thing all over again. If they didn't do that, there'd be no movie.
I say that, but I think that their motivations are actually pretty believable because...
Believable, but they have to be there, or else the T-1000 would have failed the time in the mental hospital at the very least, and he would never find them again, except as Sarah's determined to try to stop the war. So it's believable, but it's also a little contrived.
I feel like he would find them. I'm reminded of the great horror movie from last year, It Follows. Because the whole concept of It Follows is that it doesn't matter how slow the monster is moving, it will eventually get to you because it's simply that persistent. The T-1000 may not have found them immediately, but he would have continued his investigation, which he clearly was capable of doing. They're not the most inconspicuous nuclear family. Yeah. I think that he probably would have figured out eventually where they were, and they never would have felt safe until he was gone. So Sarah's plan to, while they're strong, while they have access to all of these resources, and they have the T-800, Arnold, to go and destroy Cyberdyne. It's actually a totally sound plan. She just, you know, goes off the rails a little bit when she goes after Dyson
first. And becomes a Terminator herself, and mm-hmm. Cameron's commented on that in the commentary about how when she's outside his place and about to try to blow him away, she might as well be a Terminator. And maybe that's why, and I'm going to bring this back, it's been a few weeks since we've done this, but reasonably good questions.
Here you go. Oh, I have several lots of these.
First one I've got, is Sarah becoming an advocate for Terminator rights? He'd never get drunk. He'd never hit him. And is she saying all that in her voiceover because she is about to become a Terminator herself?
Oh, so she's just rooting for Terminator.
Like the person that says, I understand why you want to sleep with people of the same sex, because I'm gay too. Same idea. She's becoming what she's talking about that she's not currently, but she's about to become a Terminator.
Well, as much as she's a Terminator for like a split second, let's admit it, as soon as she's in the house with Dyson, she turns into this completely irrational, emotional basket case. Oh, another one of the worst lines in the movie is, you'll never know what it's like to create a life, you know, inside you. You just know how to kill and destruction.
But John smartly cuts it off and says, okay, fuck, shut up, Mom. Before that, though, when they came in, John and the Terminator, just a little bit too late, she would have killed Dyson. They would not have stopped from doing that. I think it's a critical scene where Sarah tells John she always loved him. It's her breakdown scene, and it's where she finally actually shows some emotion towards John. Earlier on, he's crying, "Why do you cry?" Nothing. That whole response that he has because he's bothered that his mother doesn't seem to actually care about him. And then she says, a couple of scenes later, that she really always loved him, of course. She's never going to be the typical mother that you see in a lot of films. But I love the moment where she goes from trying to kill somebody, changes her mind because she doesn't want anyone to die. That's the whole point of why they're trying to stop Cyberdyne from building the Terminators and getting Cyberdyne going where they're going to go, according to what she knows from the future. But within that turn of her character, she also has a moment where she turns for John's sake. And then they have the reconciliation, but a lot of movies would have drawn that out. It's just a few seconds and then it's over with. But it's a very important moment for the two of them.
It's interesting you talk about her relationship with John, because one of the things that they do over and over in the film, and I presume in the series, is they remind you that were it not for time travel, then the problems that time travel is supposed to solve would never be a problem. John Connor wouldn't exist except that they had to send a soldier back in time to protect him from the original Terminator.
And to father him in the first place.
Yeah, ultimately fathers him. If that had not happened and Sarah Connor had not experienced that trauma, then she wouldn't have raised John to be a soldier, to be like a mercenary, right? So he's brought up with this woman who's kind of borderline crazy. She's kind of crazy and trains him with guns and trains him in survival and trains him in all the things that will make him the John Connor that's actually a viable opponent to the robot warriors. Although, here's a reasonably good question for you. They open with the scene, the great scene, which is actually total overkill, but when I was 14, I was like, that's amazing. The skulls all over the ground in the playground, and the robot steps on it, and then you see this battle between the robots and the humans. In the future, if I'm fighting robots, maybe I wouldn't use bullets. Maybe I would use, like, electrical charges of some kind. And if in the future I was a robot and I was fighting humans, maybe I wouldn't use bullets. Maybe I would use poisonous gases. It's kind of absurd.
Humans against the robots, okay, the poisonous gas thing, perfect sense. I think they've got more plasma phase rifles like Arnold asked for in the first film. Just what you see here, pal, because it's a futuristic weapon. So I think when you see the scenes in the first and the second movies of them battling these things, it's not bullets like you think of from a giant machine gun. It's something that's enhanced by lasers or something like that. Some futuristic technology.
Okay.
I'll cut them that slack. But I've got a better solution to all this. Magnets, bitch!
There's so many great ways to fight robots. What about salt water or something? They rust out all their joints, ruin all their hydrolysis.
Or like Reese says in the first film, they eventually win anyway, but somehow they send back a Terminator and then the Protector through the time machine. It's just him and me! And then the other guy, and the other guy. And then the TV series version of him and me. And other ones of him and me. And other ones.
You know, very few time travel movies have ever successfully managed to portray time travel because it's just impossible to tell a story without addressing the whole paradox thing. Mm-hmm. The only movie I've ever seen do it to my satisfaction is Looper.
Yeah, I think when you talk about time travel, I've always bought into this theory that let's just say where we live in this inconsequential part of Toronto. So let's say we time travel to a few days ago and I go on to Queen Street. I simply walk or drive, ride my bike, any of those kinds of things, especially driving, I suppose. Nothing outrageous happens, but maybe I make a turn and I hold everybody up for a second. And then that affects that guy or that woman from doing the thing they were going to do. That affects the next person and the next person. The slightest little thing, the butterfly effect, as they call it, affects everything else. It's something that should mean nothing, and yet it's everything. So when you get into time travel, I buy that concept. We talked about it in Back to the Future when we did that last fall. Going back in time doesn't make sense anyway in those movies because how does Doc calculate where the Earth's going to be and the car has to be exactly in the right place? Oh, yeah. This movie, the Terminator movie is actually not just this one, but when they have the concept of this ball where the Terminators come out. We don't really see it with Reese. He falls from somewhere. It's almost like it's a different concept. It's weird. It should be the same time machine where he comes out of. We see it with Arnold in the first, second, and third movies for sure, where he's in this ball that eradicates whatever's around him, it. It destroys a truck. It destroys part of the desert in the third film. So if you were to be materialized in the middle of the Earth, well, even the machine would probably burn to death very quickly, but it would materialize and destroy whatever's around it because it's got that displacement idea. So that's kind of smart.
Yeah.
But yes, whenever you go back in time and change any little thing, I don't think it holds up, but it's part of the fun of time travel movies that you have to believe it will.
And like Back to the Future, who fucking cares? Seriously, who is going to nitpick these details?
I wish you wouldn't do that in the podcasts that are about these kind of topics, because that's why we have a job. It's supposed to analyze this kind of stuff.
No, but if it mattered, it would only be because it was not a good enough movie. This is a good enough movie where you just say, I forgive it, I'm just going to enjoy
the ride. And it's been analyzed for 25 years. But I do have a question I came up with, a reasonably good one again, that I don't think a lot of people have speculated about online, because people always say, in this movie, Terminator 2, they leave the arm behind like they did in the first one.
Well, yeah, the gears of the giant machine.
Right. So the arm of the first movie and the ship, that's how they make this one happen. That was a smart little twist, and apparently Cameron wanted to do some of those things in the first film, and then they had to condense it for budgetary reasons and time constraints and just to make their compact story, and they did a good job of that. So you bring the remnants of the first Terminator into this film. Okay, that's smart, but then you have bits left over, the arm mostly, because they destroy everything else, including T-800 the second time. My reasonably good question is, was it deliberate by Cameron that they left the T-800's arm behind in the steel mill, because, as is said in Terminator 3, Judgment Day is inevitable? So they didn't do anything wrong. They would have had to split, by the way. When the T-800 boils to death and they would be standing on top of that gantry, they better get out of there pretty fast. And they probably don't even know the T-800's arm is left behind. Mm-hmm. So people have pointed out online as if that's a mistake, that they fucked up, they left this thing behind. But is that part of the whole perpetual cycle? Cyberdyne eventually is going to build these things, and no matter what they do, they're going to make some small mistake in their war against a T-800 in the first movie, a T-1000 in this movie. It has to be there to make it all work out.
I've never seen Terminator 3, and I was actually going to ask you this. I'm super curious. Do they not go back to that arm as a device?
They don't mention it, but Arnold does say, because the T-800 again comes back in time against the TX, I think they call it, and that's Christina Loken, the woman, the first time they ever had a non-Arnold, non-Robert Patrick version of a Terminator. And he says to, I guess it's about 20 or 25-year-old John Connor, played by Nick Stahl? That's his name, yes. And then Claire Danes, old Quiverchin, who plays his future wife. He tells them, Judgment Day is inevitable. So I think that people pointing out that line are wrong, because I think Cameron probably, well, he didn't know what they were going to do with the sequels, of course, at that point in 1991. But as if to say, you can try to stop this, but it's still going to happen.
You know, when Cameron left the franchise, the sequels never lived up to the first two films, and perhaps he would have used that arm as a device if he had continued.
I have another RGQ. On the same lines, did Dyson never think, when they go back to try to destroy all his work, right? They do mm-hmm. it in his home, and they go back, the whole point is to blow up Cyberdyne so nobody can follow what he's done. Did he never think that some bigwig couldn't have made copies of the Cyberdyne files, whoever his ultimate boss is that has the files back there? So then you take those, you build this anyway.
Yeah, it seems unlikely that a high-tech company like that wouldn't have backups somewhere. Mm-hmm. But whatever, cool scene. I love that moment when they leave, like, such a great kind of breath in the action, too. The tension is built up so high, and Dyson is dying. You can hear his breath and the SWAT team clearing the room. And then he's got that thing hanging over the detonator. I always loved that scene. I thought it was
that
so cool.
Thing, I did not know for the longest time. I only learned this maybe 5 or 10 years ago, is part of a model of the chip that they found from the first Terminator.
Oh.
I guess you see it in his home.
Yes.
And then it's supposed to actually be in the office, too. I never picked up on that until I saw a deleted scene or read about it somewhere. In any case, that's the irony, too, is he's using a model of what all started this to destroy everything. And in that scene, too, you've got two TV stars of the modern era who are certainly not TV stars back then. Joe Morton from one of your favorite shows, Scandal.
Oh, Papa Pope.
And Dean Norris, who plays the lead SWAT guy from Breaking Bad.
I didn't recognize him because he has the gas mask on.
Yeah, right. He was also in Total Recall. He's Tony, the guy on Mars with the mutant face who's helping out Arnold and his buddies in Total Recall. So he was in two straight Arnold movies, 1990 and 1991. We keep mentioning Judgment Day, which is, according to this movie, August 29th, 1997. We're long past that date now. We're almost 20 years past that date, fact. I think it's been changed in some of the movies and also in the TV series. I don't really follow the rest of them as closely as I do this one. But if it is inevitable that it's going to happen... That's part of what I think this movie is great about. Terrific setup and payoff, including recurring lines. It got hokey after a while, the I'll be back and come with me if you want to live. And a lot of other lines too, but those two especially recur throughout. But it's nice payoff in the first and second movies when they do those kinds of things. Arnold's big I'll be back line's been in so many movies, of course, but it started with the first one. And I was reading when I saw that movie that he was supposed to have said, I'll come back. Instead it's I'll be back.
So you're talking about Judgment Day being inevitable. Well, one of the main themes of the film is this notion that humanity is doomed to no matter what they do, because human nature is violent.
Also known on the nose scene between John and the Terminator. Are we doomed? People, I mean. Yeah. But then he's also a 10-year-old kid. There's nothing wrong with him asking questions of this machine that would have knowledge of all kinds. I have detailed files.
But I do not know what tears are.
That's a good point. He knows all about anatomy and how he can fix bullet wounds. And he does surgery on Sarah in some deleted scenes when she's been cut open. I don't think they show that in the movie itself. But actually, there's a great scene that they cut out for us. Very smart reason. This is one of those movies where you should watch the deleted scenes. They're really well done. Especially one where they have this whole dispute. John and Sarah are working on trying to fix his wound so he can pass as human, because he's going to bleed like a human would because he's got that skin on the outside. But then when she's trying to fix something in his head, they open it up and then she pulls out his chip and she's going to destroy it. And then John stops her. And his whole point is, if my own mother won't listen to me, then who else will in the future? How can I be this great leader if you won't listen to me, Mom? The point, though, is that when they show them working on Arnold, what they do is this brilliant thing. Cameron's so good with technicals. Obviously, this movie's known for the visual effects. They're still cool 25 years later.
Yeah.
But in the scene they show them doing surgery on the Arnold Terminator, they pretend there's a mirror they're looking into. Linda Hamilton's double, who we see later on in the film when the T-100 is impersonating her, is in the, I guess, the foreground because her back is facing. So Linda Hamilton, we can see her face. And then Edward Furlong's in the quote-unquote mirror shot. And then his stunt double is in the foreground. Arnold's in the mirror shot. And then they just have this mock-up Stan Winston. Brilliant Stan Winston. Did all kinds of great effects on the first movie and this one. And so many other great films. Jurassic Park. And, oh my God, the resume for that guy is incredible. I see why they cut the scene. But when you look at it, it's so cool. Because it looks like they're actually operating on Arnold Schwarzenegger's head. But it's just this cool thing where they've got stunt doubles and twins. And a machine standing in for the actors.
I did not know. I gotta check that out now.
If you're really interested in this movie and you haven't watched those before and you happen to have the Blu-ray or the DVD, take a look at the deleted scenes because they're enlightening, but I see why you cut them out. Most of the time people cut out deleted scenes for a reason, and that really applies to T2 as well. There's also that fun scene where John teaches the Terminator to smile, and then he has this inability to actually create a smile. They do that in Terminator Genesis as well, when he tries to smile at Reese, who comes back in time, the Jai Courtney version of Reese, and it's kind of funny.
Speaking of doubles, Linda Hamilton's double is her actual twin sister, Leslie Hamilton. And there's two sets of twins because, as most people know, the security guard that T-1000 morphs into is a pair of identical twin actors.
Because everyone's going to look at that and say, how did you do that visual effects-wise? But they didn't have to do a visual effect. I mean, obviously the... Well, then again, no. The thing where he points the knife thing through its eye, there may not be that many visual effects in that because you have quick cutting. You don't have to have the actual thing poke the eye's guy. I think actually you do see it poke, but it would have been a double. It would have been a machine that they would have used for the other guy at that point. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So when the T-1000 comes out of the floor, obviously visual effects, CGI, which was brand new, or very new at least in 1991, and a cool effect at that. But most of the rest of that scene is not visual effects. Just like there's that one moment, it's a very small thing, Cameron points out in the commentary. The T-1000 stabs the guy with the tanker truck towards the end of the film, in the big chase on the highway. So, of course, it should have that morphing effect on the arm. It goes back to being an arm. We've seen that plenty of times in the film, including when it impersonates Jeanette Goldstein, who was the badass in Aliens.
Yeah, I didn't recognize her.
No one does. Yeah.
She's killing, Vasquez.
Killing Xander Berkeley, who's been in so many, I think 200 credits is what that guy has. I turned to you during that scene and said, that guy's been in more movies than any of these people in this entire film. Guy who plays Todd Voigt. But yeah, we see that effect then. And then Cameron points out, you've sold it already, that the T-1000 can go back to being this humanoid character, but it's silver for a minute, that when it kills the truck driver and the T-1000 is getting the truck, you hear the sound effect and you also see the arm being silver. They said all they did was put tinfoil on Robert Patrick's arm because it just stood in for what we already know is this morphing effect. It was good enough. We've already seen it for 2 hours. We don't need to see it yet again.
It's a quick shot with a lot of motion too, which of course stops you from being able to stop and analyze it. You can't take your eyes off the effects. They're just incredible. They still look amazing. Now, 25 years later, you know, that famous shot of him morphing through the prison bars... Yeah. Still looks so good. And it's not just that it looks good because people give T2 credit for being the first film to use these effects, but not only was it not the first film, it wasn't even the first James Cameron film.
The Abyss.
The Abyss used these effects. It's just that these liquidy characters, they weren't nearly as cool as the T-1000. They just really weren't all that memorable. There's actually way more memorable things about The Abyss, which I think is an underrated film. I don't know why.
I agree.
Yes, the ending is totally disappointing, which is the part with all these special effects. But there's so much cool stuff in that movie. But the scenes in Terminator 2, they're not just better than the stuff that happened in The Abyss, but they're effects used well. And there's only, if you accumulate all the scenes...
Not that many.
There's 5 minutes.
Oh, really?
That's it. Oh. They took a team of 35 people, $5 million, 10 months to create those 5 minutes of screen time. So if you can imagine, and I can imagine, because I'm an editor and I've spent days on end in the edit suite working on one thing, and you just drive yourself crazy looking at frame after frame, you know, over and over. I can't imagine what it's like to be that guy who spent 10 months on probably one shot.
Yeah.
Because you would have teams that would just work on one shot, just that prison... door morphing thing, whatever we might call
most of the CGI would have been the T-1000, because Arnold's mostly in makeup as he gets broken down and shot at and obliterated as it goes along. When we see in both the first movie, for sure, but even the second movie, the future and all the flying weapons of death and whatnot, I'm pretty sure I've heard this. I know in the first movie this is true, that they were just models.
It's hard to remember because it's so well done. Just how brand new and revolutionary this technology was. And it really did help make the film a success, kind of like The Matrix did in 99. It was part of the draw that got audiences to see the movie in the first place. Of course, they then saw it over and over again and bought it on home media because it's just such a fun film. But those scenes are totally cool. James Cameron, I shit on this guy all the time. I have tons of problems with him as a director, but I do still love this film. And... he just has, among his talents, this incredible, uncanny eye for what looks cool. For how to make a shot that I could watch over and over again on a loop. And not even just the special effects stuff. He's a meticulous eye for detail that is what makes them look so amazing and why they still look good 25 years later. But also, and I think I said this when we were watching the film, when Arnold is on that motorcycle and they're about to go into the rain drainage things, they're having that famous chase with the motorcycles and the truck, and Arnold is twirling that shotgun around his finger. He has no expression on his face and he's just so in charge and so perfect with his movements. That shot, the motion, everything about it is just so... cool. If you had a gif of that, I don't think I could take my eyes off of it all day.
What was the movie we reviewed last week? The Great Escape. Also a very cool motorcycle moment.
So cool.
And you said that when Steve McQueen jumped over the fence trying to escape at the end of The Great Escape, and now you got Arnold, not him actually, it was a stunt double, but flying into the storm drain thing. You could see the wires even in the cleaned up special edition version Blu-ray we had, which by the way looks great. Hell of a good Blu-ray. This movie's been released over and over and over again. There's so many versions video, DVD, Blu-ray, whatever comes next. It's on Netflix, I believe. But Arnold on the motorcycle, actually, here's a curious thing I took a note of during the film. An attendant knocks off his sunglasses when they rescue Sarah Connor early on, and they never wears them again, even though it's a reverse in the first film, when he doesn't have any sunglasses for the longest time until it has to hide the eye that's been blown out during one of the chases with Reese and Sarah. Then it's got sunglasses on the rest of the film until it starts really getting destroyed right in the big climactic battle, and then, of course, it becomes the machine anyway. And it also, in the first movie, is in things like station wagons early on, the T-800 is, and then later on is on motorcycles. In this movie, it has sunglasses on the very beginning, the bad to the bone thing, right?
Yeah.
That fun moment. And is on a motorcycle right away, but then as the movie plays out, it's not on a motorcycle, so it's reverse. You start out being uncool in station wagons, no sunglasses, and then you eventually get sunglasses on motorcycles, and this one you start out with those things and then don't have them as you go along. So it's almost like he's being more domesticated in the second movie after not being domesticated in the first.
Well, what you're describing is the big reveal that was totally ruined by all the marketing material.
Yeah.
Imagine if you possibly could, going into this movie after seeing the first Terminator, blind and not knowing that the T-800 is good in this film, you wouldn't actually catch on until they're having that mall fight. You might believe, although your doubts would be cast because the T-1000 immediately kills a cop and takes, well, I guess he doesn't take his outfit, he takes his car. Then they have that chase in the mall and you wouldn't know who was the good guy and who was the bad guy until the moment that T-800 says, get down.
Yeah, and shoots then, him.
And, yeah. He's,
however, in the first film, Reese doesn't kill anybody, but he attacks cops, takes guns, steals clothes because he's got to get his mission going to try to save Sarah. So he is a criminal, but he's doing it for the right reasons. He's trying to save humanity.
Mm-hmm.
What also happens in the first film, and I watched this very carefully, is you do not see the Terminator revealed as an actual machine until Reese and the T-800 have the gunfight in the Tech Noir Club when Sarah almost gets blown away by Arnold. when he, the Cheetah Hunter, is running after them in the alley after they escape the club, that's when you see the point of view shot. That's the first time you know for sure it's a machine. In Terminator 2, we know Arnold's a machine right away.
Yeah.
We see that when it goes into the bar when it's supposed to be naked, and you get the waitresses looking down at his junk and admiring it. But just like in the first film, the more human-looking one, Robert Patrick in this film, Michael Biehn in the first one, well, Michael Biehn was actually human, of course, you don't know for sure that that's not a person until you see it do things like morphing back in after being shot by the shotgun many times, falling on the ground, and then just getting right back up and nothing's wrong with it. Oh shit, that's new!
What a great surprise it would have been for the one person in the world that saw the film without having that totally spoiled for them.
Trailers weren't as omnipresent as they are today. But yeah, you would have heard about it because the marketing on this would have been huge. I think the first teaser trailer actually was just a simple thing of showing Arnold, or at least a duplicated version of him in the assembly line. Coming this summer, Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
It was straight up blatantly marketed towards children, despite the extreme violence.
And language.
And language, yeah. And there's this pretty ironic thing when you consider that the whole theme of the film is humanity's violent nature and how that's bad and we're going to destroy ourselves, and yet you have this extremely violent movie that was being blatantly marketed to children. They have action figures, and is it an R-rated film?
Yes.
Come on! It's so hypocritical.
Well, that's more of the marketing department than it is the filmmakers. You can't really blame them for that. They didn't ask for that to happen. They certainly benefited. I'm sure they were happy to make the money off it, but they didn't ask for it to be a big marketing thing. You know what we didn't talk about a few minutes ago, and another movie that was not R, as I recall, PG-13, but hugely influenced by this one, and it was mostly T2 that made Spielberg realize he could do dinosaurs with CGI in Jurassic Park.
That's a great point. I was there when that movie came out, and I remember this, and it was a phenomenon.
And also, there are a lot of puppets and not CGI effects. There are plenty of CGI effects in Jurassic Park, of course, but there are not that many. It's way more that you think you're seeing nothing but CGI. And I'll be one of those 42-year-old guys saying, oh, these kids today. But movies that rely so much on CGI, George Lucas is the one who said it back in the Star Wars movies, the original trilogy. Special effects without a story is a pretty boring thing.
Yes.
James Cameron in this film and Spielberg in Jurassic Park are the two great examples when CGI could have just taken over everything. And they didn't really, because they both have great stories, especially T2, but Jurassic Park also.
It just allowed a great story with a lot of imagination that they couldn't have made before. They allowed that film to get made. So rather than doing special effects for the sake of special effects. And you know, you and I were just saying this week, we were watching the trailers for the BFG and the new Tarzan movie. Just watching the trailers, and presumably they're showing the best shots, it seems, honestly, like special effects are taking a big step backwards. They look terrible.
They look so phony.
The motion in it is really poorly rendered. It doesn't look remotely convincing. It just takes you out right away, and it's special effects for the sake of having special
effects.
Because
there's no way that could be real, because nobody could have created that in any way other than in a computer. And I don't want to hack on the Star Wars prequels too much, but I mentioned Lucas a minute ago and how he missed his own point with special effects. Without a story, not that great a thing. Although there is a story in the prequels. But as cool as it is to see Anakin and Obi-Wan in the third movie, especially Revenge of the Sith, flipping and flying everywhere, you know there's no way in the world that those are actual people. They have to be CGI effects. But from what we've seen with the BFG, that cannot be something they did in some studio with a giant dinosaur like in Jurassic Park. The T-Rex, T-1000 T-Rex, the T-Rex in Jurassic Park is often a giant model. The raptors are often models, not giant. Or puppets, actually, is a better example of what that is. So, another thing in T2, let's get back to that now. When the T-1000 has got into the hospital where Sarah is, and the whole point is it's going to kill her and impersonate her, it's walking down the hallway as the security guard. And then it turns into the T-1000. We hear that sound effect, that morphing sound effect happens. The camera pans away, and it pans back. And all you do is you get the actor playing the security guard, get out of the shot, Robert Patrick jumps in the shot. Doesn't cost you anything.
Yep.
Because you've already sold that this thing can do these wonderful CGI kinds of things. People talk about how you don't see enough in some movies, and it's funny how there'd be really smart movie people that will hack on movies sometimes but not showing you enough. Horror movies, it follows. Some people don't like the fact that that one doesn't really show you as much as maybe it actually could when some of these things are going on. But we've always said about horror films, what's the best thing in it? Is what you don't see, it's what you can imagine happens. And of course, the first Terminator movie is essentially a horror film. It's a chase movie. It's a stalker movie for sure, at the very least. And T2 takes advantage of the fact that you sell the effects early on and then you don't need to see it happen over and over and over again. And putting everything on camera is great. I'm thinking of the way that Alfonso Cuarón does shots, those unbroken, long shots, Children of Men, and certainly the movies he's made since, The Revenant, Gravity, have all done that. Gravity, obviously, is very CGI. Has to be. But those guys did things differently when you got a one-take shot, which also relied on CGI, and the way they did that one shot in Children of Men, they pull the car apart, the camera goes every which way. But it takes a special director to pull that kind of thing off, and you don't need to do it when you have this whole thing. You've got a guy on camera who's supposed to be this machine. Well, you just pan away, and then there's the machine.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of special directors, and just to be nitpicky, you just gave Alfonso Cuarón credit for The Revenant when it was Iñárritu.
Oh, right, yeah, the guy who directed two straight movies that won the Best Director Oscar. Oh, right, his buddy, at least.
Yes.
They're brothers, essentially. Not really, they're really good friends.
But Cuarón, they both are masters of that technique.
Yes, that's why I was thinking that. Mm-hmm. There you go. They're both great. They've made movies that are very different. I probably shouldn't mix them up, but they're both good at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But not many people can really make that work. So yes, when you can do things cheaply, even in these huge budget movies, and T2, at the time, was the biggest budget movie ever.
It's embarrassing to say now. It was a budget of just over $100 million.
And the first Terminator movie made, I think it was $35 million, which was quite good. It didn't cost that much to make. And I was also reading when I watched the movie, the trivia about it on the IMDb, that it wasn't marketed very well by Hemdale. That was the company that had it at that time. That was one of the things about T2 that took it 7 years to get made, is that they couldn't get the rights from Hemdale and other companies that had it. And it was a big squabble to get it away in the first place. And then the guy who ran Carolco, I don't know how you pronounce that fucking company's name. They're dead now. They've been dead for a long time. But Arnold was a big part of that company, and I think Cameron was in and out with them. Mario Casar was one of their executives. He was an executive on this film, too. And it took a lot of work to try to get the rights away from them to make this movie in the first place.
So apparently the production budget barely made up half, or didn't even make up half, of the actual budget. Most of the money in that $100+ million budget went to paying the cast and crew. And Arnold himself was rumored to have made $15 million, and that's not counting all the outrageous perks that he demanded as a star. And it's funny because on last week's podcast, you were giving Steve McQueen a really hard time about being so demanding. I'm going to get the salary I want. I'm going to get all the perks I want. Well, Arnold is notorious for getting everything he wants and making himself very rich and powerful, taking advantage of his stardom. James Cameron, for a director doing that same sort of thing, he made somewhere between $5 and $6 million, which means that his salary for the sequel was almost as much as the budget for the whole film, Terminator.
Arnold and James Cameron have giant egos. There's no doubt about that. But at least they've been proven to have succeeded in the past. Arnold was as big a star in Hollywood going into 1991 as anybody had ever been. Certainly was then. Arnold was the man, more so than Stallone and a lot of other people around that same time. I'm not excusing behavior like that, but also going in, it's more acceptable if you're going to make all these demands before the movie's even made. McQueen was doing it on the set of Great Escape.
Oh. Okay.
They're shooting this movie with all these people on set. There's not enough for me in this film. Let's stop production. That's what they did.
That's true.
And I don't think that's what happened with T2 or any other Arnold films. So going in, you know that he's the headlining guy. He also apparently was more than willing in promotional stuff to give Linda Hamilton her credit. We haven't really talked about her that much. What a transformation, the first film. You've got, I think, well, great comparison here. Not so much physically, although maybe there's that too. Michael Corleone in the Godfather movies is a whole different person, looks and certainly attitude-wise, in the first film to the second film, but certainly by the end of the second film. Linda Hamilton is a more extreme version of that. The first film, watching it again, it's even more true. Yes, it's 7 years before. She's playing 19 years old. She wasn't actually 19 in 1984, but she's playing not even 20. And then she's this badass, bulging muscles that influenced Madonna. She said that and said, me too. And what a difference she put out there. And Arnold knew that she was pretty much his co-star, not just second or third build. It's me and then way down below it's her. It's more like it's me, but also with Linda Hamilton.
But when you watch the film, she's the star. Like, she seems to anchor a lot of the shots. She's the one that you look to. She's the one that provides the voiceover. She's the main character of the film. And we haven't talked about Edward Furlong yet, because as much as he should be more important, he's just too annoying to get invested in at all. And even though you're not really meant to like Sarah Connor, you sure as hell respect her, and you definitely root for her. She's your guy.
She's trying to save the entire planet, so the fact she's a little crazy, single-minded, and not a very loving mother, at least early on, until she has that nice moment with John and the Dyson home, I can forgive that. You say not supposed to like her. Well, she's not Forrest Gump or something like that, but she's still likable in her way, I suppose. As movie heroes go, she's one of the great ones.
I think a better way to put it would be to say she doesn't care if you like her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let me bring this up. We talked earlier about feminists. We didn't say that word, but feminism. James Cameron has been good about this for most of his career. Aliens obviously makes Sigourney Weaver's character the survivor yet again, like she was in the first film, but also gives her a purpose. She's trying to defend this kid and also save as many of the people in the platoon as she can, but she's the leader.
And the alien is a female. Right. They make that very clear. So you have the hero and the villain, badass female.
And Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, Cougar Mellencamp, as my cousin used to call her, which is always funny, in The Abyss, isn't quite on Ed Harris's par, but then the reason why that movie works as well as it actually does, and you said the effects and the on-the-nose thing about how we shouldn't destroy the world with nukes. We shouldn't destroy the world with nukes. We get it, Jim. But when she and Ed Harris reconcile, there's some great emotion in that. The whole thing with him pounding on her chest when she's been drowned.
Yeah, totally.
That is maybe his greatest acting moment ever, and that guy's had some great acting moments.
And he not only does that, but he'll also include female characters in his films that are tough broads that don't really call attention to themselves. Like, Vasquez is a great example, and in The Abyss, I can't remember the character's name, but she's...
One Night. Lisa Standing. One Night Standing.
There you go. So you have these women who are in the film. They're just there. He doesn't call attention to it. It's not like this
big part of the
feminist
team.
Character. They're just part of the team. Mm-hmm. That is almost more progressive because he presents it without comment.
True Lies, you got Jamie Lee Curtis. And the movie gets a little sexist in the middle. I know Leonard Maltin, for one, criticized the film for that reason. But she is an Arnold's level, in a way, as his wife in the film. And she's tough in her own kind of way. So that movie gets a little sexism, I guess. But that one still has a pretty strong woman. And then also a woman villain with Tia Carrere.
Yes.
And then Titanic. You got Rose.
Yeah, smartest person in the room, always. Mm. Definitely, he hits that right on the head every single time. And it's... totally annoying.
Because he's not a great dialogue writer, yeah. And he's not necessarily even a great scene writer, but his ideas for stories are fantastic over and over again. I love the story, and it's also on the Terminator making of, that when he was writing the first film, he was also writing Aliens, and he was writing, I think it's Rambo 2 at the same time. He didn't sleep. He didn't eat anything. He was broke beyond belief. And maybe that's what shows in his screenplays. He is one of those guys that if he didn't have so much power, probably be guided by a better producer to say, okay, this is fine. Let's bring in a script doctor to work on your dialogue instead, because he is always a writer, producer, director, and editor of his films, much like the Coens. But he doesn't have the same kind of eye and ear for dialogue, at the very least, that they do. That's the weakest part. Avatar is one of the worst offenders of that of all of them. Despite the fact it is still literally the biggest hit in the history of the world, in real money, not adjusted for inflation. Of course, that's gone with the wind.
And I'll repeat the sentiment that I made when we did our Titanic podcast, which is to say, we can criticize his dialogue all we want. The man obviously knows what the public wants to see. Another one of his great gifts is making real crowd-pleasing movies that people not just want to go to the theater and see, but they go over and over again.
And Spielberg, we mentioned him earlier, those two guys are not quite contemporaries because Steven was about 10 years or so before Cameron came on the scene, but they're close enough to being contemporaries. I think Spielberg's a better director. He's certainly thought of as more of a quote-unquote genius than Cameron is. But they're both guys who know what the public wants. However, Spielberg's been more of the important movie kind of guy the last 10 or so years with films like Lincoln and Bridge of Spies, which are very watchable, but then you never really want to see them again.
Yeah.
And apart from Avatar, with Cameron's resume, and actually Piranha 2, his very first film, it has to be included in his resume, I've watched his movies over and over again. Even Titanic I've seen, I think, 4 times.
That's a good point. Aliens is just, to me, one of the best action movies ever made. I can't think of a working director that does action better. Maybe as good, but not better than James Cameron does it. He knows when to speed up, he knows when to slow down, give the audience a good long look at the menacing truck or the SWAT team methodically looking for the dying Dyson and Cyberdyne. He just has that, like I said, that great eye for what looks cool and that near perfect attention to detail, the realism of the stunts and the explosions and special effects. They have an incredible impact. And he lets his heroes look scared. He'll let them express real peril, which I always love in an action film. There's nothing worse than an implacable hero.
Except Arnold as the Terminator, because he can't.
He's a robot.
Yeah.
That's okay, because it's made up for with Edward Furlong and Linda Hamilton.
The Connors.
We gotta talk about Edward Furlong briefly.
Yeah, of course we do.
He was not an actor. He had no ambitions for his acting.
This was his debut.
Yeah, he was discovered in like a massive casting search. And that was the first time he ever considered being in movies. and he was maybe not universally, but greatly hated.
He was later in American History X with Edward Norton, 1998, which is a pretty powerful film, and he's fine in that. No one's ever criticized him for that performance. I think they're a little hard on the kid. He was a young man. He wasn't 10 as he's playing in the film. He's 12.
He's 12.
Okay, there you go. So he's pretty good considering he's a 12-year-old. And it's also Cameron's dialogue. You call him, wah, a douchebag? Well, that's
he's
written.
Trying his best, but you know, it takes a pretty world-class actor to make those lines sound anything except idiotic. And he pulls some of them off better than others.
There are a lot of nice touches in the film, and some of them involve his character. One is he's wearing a Public Enemy t-shirt, meaning the rap band.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, he's Public Enemy to the machines in the future. He's also playing Missile Command when the T-1000 almost tracks him down in the arcade. And that's kind of what happens with the missiles. You see it in Terminator 3 when they actually are being launched. He's trying to stop nukes from... Not nukes, Missile Command, but he's trying to stop missiles from hitting the Earth. And that's the whole plot of all of these movies. By the way, let me get back to reasonably good questions. Had the T-1000 tracked down John in the arcade, would he just stab him and then what?
I don't know.
Whatever happened to these Terminators if they actually accomplished their mission?
I guess
I'll go on vacation, as Arnold says. I need a vacation.
Maybe they self-destruct. What would take more resources, creating a new T-1000 or getting the T-1000 back to the future?
Oh, you know what? Deleted scenes. We talked about this a minute ago with that surgery thing. I think they should have left this in. When they get to the steel mill towards the end, the T-1000 has been blown up and reformed many times, and this is probably why it happens. You see a moment, and it's why John actually realizes for sure that the Linda Hamilton double, or her sister as you pointed out, was the T-1000. It's not just that his mother says, "Get out of the way, John," and then shoots a hole through it. But he also looks down and sees that its feet are not quite merging properly. And when the T-1000 comes after them, after it reforms when the Hasta la Vista, baby scene happens, it merges with a banister when it tries to climb up some stairs. It's having problems reforming itself. And it's such a brief moment when it shows the feet that are merging to the grate in one of those scenes. It really should have been in the film, I think, to show that the T-1000 is malfunctioning. I mentioned nice touches with John's character. Now, just in the whole movie, nice touches. The vivid nuclear blast they show in Sarah's nightmare. People who know all about nuclear explosions in reality say that is one of the best versions of it ever put on film.
Well, it gave me nightmares.
And then the animatronic puppets. That's more so in the first film when you see that. When Arnold's become just the machine underneath that's coming after them. Yeah, that is mostly puppeteering. You see some of that in this film, too. Not as much. And the great touches with all the twins. The model of the chip that blows a detonator. Again, story ideas better than screenplay ideas.
Yeah.
So the ending, and you didn't like the line, even though I've always liked that line. I don't know why you cry, but it's something I can never do.
Come on.
But I do have to ask this question that applies to many parts of the film, including at the end when it's, I order you not to go, I order you not to go, and then he starts crying. How can even a Terminator that learns, be capable of defying direct orders from John?
Dude, why would John Sr., I don't know, John in the future, ever program this robot to follow everything he said as a 10-year-old. That's just a terrible idea.
Well, he can't guarantee that he'll have any help from his mother or anyone else. Who else is he going to rely on except himself?
Well, you rely on it, but you can't program a robot to listen to a 10-year-old if you want it to succeed in its mission. 10-year-olds are idiots. Everybody knows that.
Even though he's had this whole life of being raised with Green Berets and Mercs and all these kind of guys, he doesn't really seem like he's learned... Well, actually, he's learned plenty of things, hasn't he? But he doesn't seem like he's ready for it the way you might think. The way that she is. I mean, she's this sinewy... Well, that's the thing. I wrote this note down when we saw the film. She's all sinew and anger.
She trained like a boss for this movie. And she won James Cameron's heart.
They were married, one of his many wives.
Very shortly after he split with his previous wife. And then he left Linda Hamilton for the actress from Titanic.
Susie Amos.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the Titanic Oscar, she's in the crowd. Linda Hamilton is with him when he went up there 3 different times to win Oscars. She was his wife and she was his seatmate.
He was at that time having an affair with Susie Amos.
Is that proven? He was actually with her, or was it after the
fact? Well, she said after they split up, the reason for their divorce was because he was carrying on an affair. They must have started the affair inside. I mean, I guess I don't know. But it seems unlikely. And it's funny that this guy has made all these really great, iconic female characters who are so strong and badass and truly feminist characters.
And then he fucks them.
He's been married 4 times. What is this guy's deal with women?
And he directed Michelle Rodriguez in Avatar, and she can look as good as any of them. She's cool. She's a badass. She got that snarl. She's hot as hell. Man, I guess maybe he tried to get her in. Or maybe he's happy with Susie Amos now. He's finally settled down. All right, so we talked about the cast, but a few more notes about them. Arnold is in his best role ever, and he knows that. He's mentioned the Terminator movies in so many different places, including when he ran for governor. I was the Terminator. bigger crowd pop. We know, you fucking asshole. But he was great in this role. He's strong and silent. He only has 700 words in the whole film. I think he's got fewer in the first one. It's just about 45 minutes shorter as well, or maybe 40 minutes shorter. So it would be fewer words, I guess, from that standpoint. But you mentioned the physical acting.
Oh, yeah.
That moment when the truck flips over on the road towards the end of the film before they get to the steel mill, and the guy in that little truck that they steal looks at them, he just raises his eyebrows. Now his face has been ruined a little bit. You see the metal underneath. That one look, that's worth the money you pay for the guy.
Yeah.
And his physicality on the motorcycle early on. You mentioned the twirling shotgun. Amazing. He's got that John Wayne, Clint Eastwood charisma, that quality. Steve McQueen was not a big, muscular-looking dude. I mean, Arnold's the most muscular leading man of all time, I would say. But he's got that poise, charisma look that you can never possibly duplicate and probably never will duplicate again. There's always been that question, and I do kind of answer it in the deleted scene in Terminator 3, of why you would give this supposed infiltration unit, especially in the first film, an Austrian accent, let alone making him enormous, yeah. But give him this accent in America. But that's only because this guy can't, much like Sean Connery, ever sound different than he always does.
Yeah.
Robert Patrick, he has not come up much in this podcast yet. This is maybe his best role so far. He's been in a ton of movies. He's a great character actor. He's been in dozens and dozens of things. But he had the right size and look to blend in. That's what Cameron thought about in the first film. I was reading that Lance Henriksen was never going to play the Terminator. I'd always heard that that was the case in the first film, but now I was just reading last night that that wasn't the case. But anyway, the idea should be that you've got someone who looks like a Lance Henriksen, or a Michael Biehn, or a Robert Patrick. Someone who's very average-looking that just comes about and just kills you because you don't know that they're any kind of weapon. It doesn't have to be some enormous Austrian. It can be the small as our dog if it's got the abilities of a T-1000 or a T-100 to just blow you away or to stab you with a weapon.
And his banality is part of his menace, that he does blend in, that he does just look like a dad. He looks like the most normal dude, but he's such an amazing, sinister, menacing villain. He is terrifying. And you don't talk about physical performance. He also hits it out of the park with the way he runs, with the way he moves, with the way everything he does is with such graceful intention. He's almost like a dancer. He has such perfect posture and balance at all times, and he never lets his guard down and slips up. There's some things that are clearly intentional, and I think it's actually pretty dumb near the end of the film when he does the wagging finger thing. No, he wouldn't do that.
The Terminator's single-minded, and John's right there. Of course he wouldn't do that. No.
No, he just wants to kill him, and that's what he would do. He wouldn't waste time being smug about it.
Just like, call to John, I know this hurts. Why wouldn't you just kill her? Because the whole point of that kind of machine is you're going to impersonate her anyway. As soon as you've touched her, you can impersonate her. You don't need her. Why wouldn't you kill her? Of course, Arnold does save her, but then he does the whole thing with the pokey device right towards her eyeball. He could have easily killed her four or five different times in that moment before the T-100 comes along and whaps him with the giant crowbar.
That part is kind of silly.
But yes, it's a strong performance. And I was reading that he based it on a lot of different things, including bald eagles.
Oh.
The way he had that look and that the way the bald eagles look, I guess.
No expression whatsoever. Mm. And it does make them scarier. His face, the way he rounds a corner, still can somehow give me a chill.
Mm-hmm.
I can't explain how thoroughly captivating he is. I know that Arnold made the villains list as well as the heroes list.
He did.
But did Robert Patrick just T-1000?
All right, so jumping ahead on the list section, the T-800 was 48th on the light side of the heroes and villains list from this movie. And then the other version from the first Terminator was 22nd on the villains list. And Arnold is the only one who crossed over and had a hero and a villain. And of course, it's effectively the same character. Al Pacino had, he's the other one, had a hero and a villain. He was Serpico, and he was also Michael Corleone in the second movie, so that's the villain for him. But Arnold is essentially the same character, and that's a great twist. The T-1000 was nominated for the top 50 villains, didn't quite make it. And we said plenty of times in the last few months of our podcast that the Joker from The Dark Knight, of course, wasn't eligible, and then Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men, not eligible, would definitely have made the top 50 villains list. T-1000 belongs there, too. How many people get to knock out to put all these great villains on that weren't on that list? That was a pretty good list. I criticized the AFI list many times. I did like the Throws list, and I did like the Heroes and Villains list for the most part. But yeah, the T-1000 probably belongs.
You cannot underestimate the power of a great villain, and so many of the greatest villains are the ones that are completely opaque and have no motivations, have no emotions. You know, I'm thinking about Michael Myers, even like the Darth Vader in Star Wars, not Anakin, when he gets ruined. But when you have these mysterious villains, they're just that much more menacing.
It's funny how whenever an effects movie comes up, the Star Wars seems to come up in the conversation.
Well, Star Wars comes up in a lot of movie conversations.
It did influence so much in Hollywood, for sure. And blockbuster sequels is one of the things that influenced. Okay, so a few tech people briefly will go through those guys. You got 2-3-5-1 movie, watch the Blu-ray, of course. Kick-ass sound design, still an incredible sound mix. And the Blu-ray looks pretty damn good for a movie that is 25 years old, although the Blu-ray wasn't 25 years ago, but you know what I mean. The cinematographer was Adam Greenberg, who shot the first Terminator movie and Ghost the year before this one. The editor was Mark Goldblatt, who edited the first film, and also he worked with Conrad Buff and Richard A. Harris, so they all had different things to do on this long movie. The best one of the three of them, I think, even though the movie was shot and edited very well, and those things were nominated, in fact, but Brad Fidel, or Fidel, I think it's Brad Fidel, the iconic, and then whenever you see the Terminator point of view, I can't do that music, but you know if you've seen these movies enough to know what that music is, and the so many different themes in this film that are so well known, and the third movie, even though I think Terminator 3 is pretty good, does not use that music until the end credits. You fucking kidding me? It's part of the whole series. What's wrong with you? Jonathan Mostow, but Fidel, what the fuck his name is. He also did music on True Lies, which was Cameron's next film. Great music in this film. It isn't as good in the first movie. It isn't as filling the room, maybe, is part of the problem with it, because it isn't stereo surround. And we mentioned Stan Winston, the other tech guy. Wow.
Yeah, wow.
If you know your movies, you know that name. He was so good. He's been dead for quite a while now, but he was outstanding when it came to visual effects, puppets, and then we got into CGI. He's one of those people that is not talked about enough in the history of Hollywood because he wasn't an actor or a director or even a studio head.
And you can't exaggerate how perfect these effects turned out.
Okay, we've talked about a lot of influence. Let's cover a few more. So you got all the sequels and the TV series. The theme park ride at Universal Studios, which they made essentially a short film of. It's not technically in James Cameron's directing oeuvre. He's only made 8 films. But that's in there as a, theme park ride or something like that? Like a video short kind of thing would be for somebody. That was an expensive theme park ride that they made, though.
$60 million. Right. It was the most expensive per minute film production or entertainment production ever made.
And they got Arnold and Eddie Furlong. I think they got Robert Patrick back for that. I don't think they got Linda Hamilton, but a lot of the big cast members to do that thing, too. And then there's this, a sequel that far surpasses the success of the original. Not that it's a better movie. I think the first one's maybe, debatably, I love them both so much, but debatably a better film for what it's supposed to be. It's also a different film. Like I say, you got a horror chase film, and then you've got the second one is a sci-fi, also a chase film, but more about action, for sure. But just the blockbuster success. And I'm also so impressed, we talked about it already, that the studio greenlit Arnold's salary, Cameron's salary, and the budget for the film in general on a movie that did fine, did very well, exceeded its budget, made quite a bit of money, but was not a blockbuster. In 84 is when you started seeing blockbusters.
I don't think it was Terminator that got this film greenlit. I think it was Aliens. Terminator got everybody in the world to pay attention to James Cameron, but Aliens proved that he wasn't just this one-hit wonder, that he was the real deal.
Well, fair enough. And Arnold, as I said a few minutes ago, was the biggest star in the world. You combine those two things, and what they probably thought was a good screenplay, and they're right, it was a good screenplay. Well, okay, again, good story, but not a good screenplay. But they saw dollar signs, and they were right to do it, because what a monster hit it was. The awards and list section is one of the bigger ones we've had in quite a while. 4 Oscars. Visual effects, obviously, it should have won that. Sound should have won that. Sound effects should have won that.
Yeah.
And for the makeup. It did not win for the editing or the cinematography. JFK won those two, and that's a good choice, but I would have been fine with it winning, I think, those two as well. You like editing, you talk about it plenty of times. This is a movie about 2:15 long, give or take.
You could teach a course about action scene editing and use this film as an example. The way they build up the tension before they make things move really quickly. It's so well done. It's perfect.
I think Mark Goldblatt, who edited the first one, like I said, by himself, maybe should have been nominated for the first film. Actually, no, he should have been nominated for the first film. Maybe even should have won, because there's some great edits in the first Terminator. Maybe even more so than this one. And you don't have that laggy pace, but it's also required. A friend of mine has always ripped on the middle section when they're in the desert. And then you do have some of the things about how are humans doomed to kill themselves? And then Linda Hamilton's no fate stuff. But you also need that, A, for a bit of a lull before you get to the big sequence from Cyberdyne right towards the end of the film, but also to give these characters motivation, especially Sarah Connor. All right, so back to the list section. It was 77th on the top 100 of Thrills, and it's the only sequel on the Thrills list. Hasta la vista, baby, was 76th on the top 100 quotes list. And the movie was 8th in the sci-fi category of the top 100 genres. One of my favorite parts of any list is the sci-fi category of the top 100 genres.
So even though it didn't make the AFI's top 100 films of all time list. It has, like, ranked really highly in other organizations' list of top films of all time. Total Film has a famous list of the top 100. It's 33rd. Empire does another one. It's 35th. And they called it the third greatest sequel of all time.
I'm guessing Godfather 2 and Empire Strikes Back are
both. Oh, totally. Yeah, I didn't even have to check. It's just so transparent.
I love this movie. I've seen it, I don't know how many times. It's got to be at least 12 times. And it's one of those I've watched little bits of here and there, too, including, and you didn't even like it, but the I Don't Know Why You Cry thing, because I think it's Arnold's best moment. And it also gives humanity to a film that is all about inhumans. The non-human hero and villain, and then the Linda Hamilton not being very human through so much of the film, and then some kid. But forget that part. The movie as a whole affects the story, the sound, the impact on culture, the fact it's still cool and memorable and fun 25 years later. It's also very dark. Right from the very beginning, you got this apocalyptic opening credits sequence. Very unusual for a blockbuster in 1991, or any year for that matter.
Could have been another thing that it influenced.
Yes.
To make
the Batman darker, movies, yeah. Which are not exactly fun, but they're great. Okay, anyway, your thoughts.
Well, I think Terminator 2 looks better at age 25 than Avatar looks at age 7 right now. Like, it is already outdone that film as far as looking back and enjoying it as much as you did when you first saw it. It's hard to dwell on the flaws that we talked about when what T2 does do well could still stand up next to any action blockbuster in the theaters now.
And this coming up to the July 4th weekend, people will be looking for movies of this type. Independence Day, the sequel, must be coming out around the same time, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
That might be fun. That might be great. But you know what? If you got nothing else to do and you don't really want to pay your $15 for the hell it costs to go to the movies these days, or a lot more than that for 3D and all the rest of that jazzed up bullshit, then just sit down with this one in your living room and enjoy it all over again.
Yeah, it won't disappoint you. It has aged so goddamn
As if I need to convince people to watch
it. Yeah, I know. No kidding.
Okay, well, we're dark next week for Canada Day and the 4th of July. However, this week was going to be a review of The Shallows. We picked T2 instead, nice lead in with a week off. But The Shallows, that movie about the shark and Blake Lively, we intend to go see it and cover it as a website-only bonus sometime in the next week. You'll have to go to toponunderproject.com for that. And if we don't do it, we apologize. But we won't actually post it as an iTunes thing. It'll be a website-only extra, so go there and help us out with some hits on our website. But when we get back to our regularly scheduled podcastery on July 11th, we take a glance at an 80s classic that will be getting a lot of talk later in the week. We'll have a review of the 1984 version of Ghostbusters! So the coming attractions trivia for Ghostbusters. Who were the original casting choices for Winston, Lewis, Gozer, and Venkman?
Please visit the website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. And while you're there, you can also peruse our now massive list of podcasts we've already done. Everything's always online.
For free.
And, yeah, for free. And it includes all 123 movies that ever made the AFI's Top 100 list, either in 1998 or 2007. There's got to be a bunch of films that you love, so go check it out. You can find both Ryan and me on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
End this podcast if you want to live.
We'll be back. And cut.